Welcome to the Product Design Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Coolin, founder of UX Cabin, where we create world-class web and mobile apps. I'm excited to bring you a behind-the-scenes look into the lives of some of the most interesting and talented people in product design. We'll get strategic advice on how they got to where they are today and things they wish they would have known earlier in their career. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining the Product Design Podcast today. We have a really exciting show for you. We have Elizabeth Alley. She is a product designer, a mentor, and a founder here with us today. And I'm excited to dive in and get all of her insight and wisdom on the product design space. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Seth. It's very lovely to spend some time chatting with you here.
Yeah. So why don't you start us off with who you are and what you do?
So currently I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I am a product designer in UX, UI, and digital products. I've been doing the web and product design thing for 14 long years now. And currently I'm the founder of Designer Up School, where I teach UI, UX, and product design with a mindful approach. And we also teach business and strategy along with that. And I also have a YouTube channel where I do lessons and tutorials on the same topic.
Awesome. That is so cool. I am so stoked to be able to talk to you today and get into some of your history, your background, and some of your knowledge in this space. So yeah, why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit like how you got started in design in general and how you got to where you are today?
Well, it's a twisty road, like I know a lot of UX designers can say, but from as far back as I can remember, I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a classical concert pianist. I loved performing. I really loved making music. I was born in New York, and I was kind of really influenced by my family's just love of like good classical music, opera, good films, that sort of thing. I grew up in Florida, and I went to performing arts high school there, and I studied classical piano. I moved on to university, and I studied classical piano and pedagogy, which is basically just a fancy word for teaching and like the art and science of how people learn. And I also studied sound engineering and business. And then I eventually became a music teacher. And so I was kind of building up my private piano practice at the time, and I needed a website. Went to my brother, Eric, who was in web design and development at the time. And this was around 2007. So he kind of started showing me like the ins and outs of WordPress and just using, you know, site builders to piece together things. And I got really into it, especially like the graphic and the visual stuff and just all the little nitty gritty things I could tweak and move. And one of those things where I started to go down the rabbit hole, just wanting to know more and more and more. And, you know, he saw what I was doing. And then he like said to me in this, you know, typical reluctantly complimentary younger brother way, like, it's not bad what you're doing. You want to come do some work for me? Yeah, it's paid. And I was like, you know, sure, I'll try. My classical music students aren't really coming in by the waves right now. So the first thing I ever designed was for one of his clients. And it was this little ad banner. And I think I got paid like $300 for it. Probably took me 2 hours to do. I certainly was not getting paid that much by the hour as a classical piano teacher. And I really liked it. You know, it was still kind of getting to be creative and, you know, do all the little things that I like to do. But much unlike my career in classical music, which is very much demanding of perfection and precision, right? Of every note, of every, you know, of everything that you play. I could go back in web design and fix things. I could tweak things. I could do it again if I messed up. And I really loved that. Like your production push was never the final push ever that was going to be out there. It wasn't like going on stage and that was it. That was what people heard. So I think, you know, that was that onset for me of it just feeling like all of these things I had been doing and learning and interested in came together in this work. And I feel that's a story I've heard from a lot of designers. It's sort of that soul searcher's profession where, you know, a lot of seemingly disconnected things come together for them. So kind of what was just this side gig slowly turned into my main gig over time. And Eric and I started our first design agency a year later in 2008. And yeah, that was the start.
That is incredible. So piano teacher to web designer. That seems like a pretty vast stretch. Did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams that you would make that sort of career switch?
No, not at all. And it was definitely not without struggle and debate. I think as it just became harder to find classical music students, and it was kind of a dying art, and there were a lot of issues happening with our opera and our symphony. They were going bankrupt at the time in the city that I was in, so there just weren't a ton of opportunities. So it was, hey, I've wanted to do this my whole life. I'm like kind of stepping into this new world I know nothing about. I don't know if I should stick with what I've been doing forever and just keep, you know, trying to chase this dream, or should I like see where this is going to take me and how it might evolve. So it was a big leap of faith to try and do something different. But I think it was always that thing where I was so interested, like the hours would just melt away learning about this stuff and doing it. It was kind of calling to me. So yeah, I went with it.
Ultimately. That's incredible. I think so many people are in that position currently where they've been doing something for so long and they have something that's like a career that's so part of their identity. And for one reason or another, they're kind of exploring the switch. Mm-hmm. And do you have any insight or wisdom to give to people as they evaluate that? If it's a good switch, if they should make the leap, or how do they know if it's going to be something that's going to be right for them?
Yeah, I think that if you somehow came across this as a viable career option and you're interested in it, but you haven't come from a graphic design background like I haven't, I did not study that formally in school. I self-taught mostly and had mentors and people like my brother along the way and, you know, YouTube to turn to. If you are in that position right now and you have some interest in it, just know how many different avenues there are and how many paths that you can create for yourself that you might not even know about yet. Like I say that this career, UX, it was not even a profession when I was deciding what to major in. There was no such thing as user experience design back in 2000. Really, I mean, it wasn't common. And so you never know, right? These are core skills that you will use in anything, being able to talk to users, understanding business, like no matter what you do, I think there's so much value in these skills, just in having that tech acumen and that business acumen. So I would say that it will never hurt you to explore this as a path and to apply what you learn to whatever you end up doing. But also, there's that little thing where, you know, I kind of do a body check and I say, if this is something that energizes me, and I keep wanting to know more and I keep coming back to it, that's a pretty good sign to go in that direction. If it's something that's draining me, that's taking my life force away, that's not bringing me joy, I'm moving too far away from my value spectrum that I want to be on. So I'm going to, you know, go back. And it may not be for everyone, but just know that there's a lot of different paths and a lot of different things that you can do in this space. So I don't think it's ever even a waste of time to explore.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think a lot of people, a lot of friends who have reached out to me and they're like curious about what I do and like what it entails and what it would look like for them if they wanted to get into it. And like typically what I do is like if someone asks me or approaches me about UX or front end development or product design, I'll typically send them like a handful of videos and maybe a few tutorials and like just kind of see, what do you think about this? And a lot of folks, they watch those and that's the end of it. And that's totally fine. It's, you know, either not for them or didn't grab their interest. But like, if you watch some tutorials, if you do some exercises and you're like you said, energized by this, and you can do this without watching the clock, and it's just like, you're excited to do it, I think that's a really good indication that you should pull on that thread more.
Yes.
And I also think there's like, coming from, as most of us are coming from, like a traditional like schooling background where you almost feel like anything you learn or any like profession you go into like almost has to be taught to you or like you have to like sit in front of someone to learn it. It's like that's not really the case. Like, you can learn by reading, you can learn by watching, you can learn by doing your own thing. And it's not, there's not like a gatekeeper in UX. That's one of the things that's like, oh, like I can figure out what I like, what I want to do, what I'm interested in, and learn it on my own, learn on it with people, with other people's, or like pick my like community to learn from.
Yeah, that is so true. It's a different mentality, I think, if you do come from that space where you have to major in something, you have to get a degree, you have to be credentialed before you start. It is hard for people to believe that you can make the same amount of money as doctors and lawyers in a profession that you can teach yourself. And I think that's something that stops people from saying, yeah, but, and especially like in, you know, if you're coming from a, like an immigrant culture, like you don't have a degree in that, you're probably not going to make any money in it, are you? Well, that's not the case in this. And like you said, you can kind of, you know, there will always be gatekeepers, I think, but in UX, you can always find another entrance. And that's what I love about it.
Yes, that's so true. That's so true. And it's like in UX and business, I think like certainly at companies, there's going to be politics and gatekeeping and whatnot. But it's like, if you're good enough, you can even put yourself out there in the market as a freelancer on, you know, different job posting sites. And like, your work will speak for itself. And like you said, there's lots of doors that you can knock on and opportunities that you might be able to go through that might not be the traditional corporate job approach.
Yeah, exactly. And I have been through all of them. So yeah, there's a lot of different things you can do for sure.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about like your career trajectory as like you kind of got into the WordPress space in that ecosystem. How did you navigate that over time to find where you are today?
Yeah. So when we started our design agency, a lot of the client work coming through was, we have a corporate website, we want to do a full redesign of it, and we want to put it on a CMS where the marketers who have no design or technical experience can update pages. That was kind of the big ask. And this was like, you know, early mid 2000s. And so we were doing a lot of those. And by virtue of that, there were a lot of clients that were like, no, these templates and these solutions have really limited functionality, and we want to be able to do this and that and the other, and can you do this? So Eric started building templates and making custom white labeled solutions and that sort of thing. And so we ended up with this catalog of templates, and we were like, hey, why don't we like build a theme shop out of this? So we kind of went in that direction. And this was kind of my sort of first foray into startup world and building a company and bootstrapping something. And so that became a thing in of itself. And that was like, you know, really how I got into founding and just being an entrepreneur and kind of running businesses through that route.
Wow. So building themes was always something on like my bucket list that I wanted to do and like sell them, like build a really awesome theme and then sell it 100 or 1,000 times. Yeah. It's a lot harder than that once you look into it, as I'm sure you guys figured out. And I never got that far. But what type of success did you guys see from trying to stand up themes and sell those? As I know the market was pretty tough there for a while for theme developers.
Yeah, you know, this was like 2008, and we had started on Envato, which, you know, Theme Forest back in the day.
Theme Forest, yeah.
Yep. And what was funny was we found these niches that no one was touching. There were a couple of these big website builders. I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
It was like you could just build absolutely any type of website with it. But there was a lot of technical overhead, and it was almost like learning Webflow is today, right? It was pretty complex how many options they had. So we went the exact opposite route, and we really niched down. And one of our biggest selling themes was called Workout. And it was a theme specifically for CrossFit instructors during like the CrossFit boom, when everybody was starting up a CrossFit gym. And this thing sold like crazy. And our second biggest one was a restaurant website. So it had your menu items and your hours, and it was really simple, but it was just like something that small businesses completely gravitated towards. And so those which just blew up beyond imaginable. And so it was a lot of that niche, finding these niche areas where people did not have good solutions and they did not have a lot of technical skills. similar to the clients that we had been working with in our agency. So it was just that we saw that need through our own work, our one-on-ones with, you know, clients and consulting. And then we scaled that in a marketplace that we actually had some room to, you know, grow and where we didn't have to completely shoulder all of the business decisions. And then eventually that became so successful that we just had our own shop, our own like premium theme shop off of ThemeForest.
That is so cool. I don't know for you, but for me personally, no matter like how high of like an hourly rate or a salary you get, to me, nothing feels better than selling a product when you're sleeping.
Oh man, the joys are just unparalleled. It hits different, let me tell you.
Absolutely. You had this kind of theme shop and that grew over time. What did you get into next that led you more towards where you're at today?
Yeah. So, you know, we bootstrapped a bunch of different products and companies. We built a music instruction site on Ruby on Rails. That was a crazy huge project, which we ended up selling. And so we exited a couple of those things. But a big shift happened when Eric was offered a crazy position out in Silicon Valley to work for a startup that was just growing really, really rapidly. They were going through Y Combinator at the time. So they were a startup and just he kind of wanted to try that world out. And so he left me to run the business on my own, the theme shop, everything we were booting, yeah, the agency, all of it. I was put into the fire because I had to do all the stuff I did not know how to do. I did not like doing the business, the client negotiations, oh, and the customer support. If anything has taught me more about product design, it was customer support. When you see people trying to do things with your product that are not possible and using it in ways that you've never intended and having to solve for that, you learn a lot about tech, about users, about mental models, like about engineers.
Game theory.
So and that stuff really taught me a lot. It just taught me how to be a very self-sufficient designer, business person, user advocate, all of that. So that was a big one. And then I started to have Eric saying, I need your help on this project out here. I really need your design eye for this. I need this. And so I started spending more time out in Silicon Valley and doing consultant work for the startups out there. And I sort of really got into that. And when I made that move out to NorCal, that was a whole different ballgame for me. So that's when I really got into working for like B2B companies and B2C companies. And yeah, that was a new space, a new frontier.
Wow. Now, during this time, did you ever struggle with imposter syndrome?
Do you ever stop struggling with that? They're lying to you if they tell you that, you know, they don't, because yeah, for sure. And also I think probably because of my background in classical music, you don't have mentors that are giving you a lot of positive criticism and saying like, you know, that's really good, but you might want to adjust this. It was more like, that was terrible. Did you even practice this week? It was just kind of this. I was taught in this Russian school of music and it was very strict and it was very demanding of perfection. And so a lot of, I think, the imposter syndrome came from my internalizing those voices and always feeling like it could be better. Like at one point, not too long ago, is when I realized those voices weren't mine. You know, they really weren't mine. They were just, it was just the fear and the criticism and all of that kind of stuff. And I talked a lot about this on my channel as well, and just kind of how befriending that was one of the greatest things I ever did, just having a relationship with that imposter and just saying like, we're all learning. You know, everything is learnable and everything is negotiable. Like in any situation, I just kind of remind myself of those three things. And I find that to be very helpful because, and I know you'll hear this time and time again from designers, like we all go through it. I still do all the time. So yeah, it's just something that is you kind of walk with. You learn to walk with, I think.
Yeah, that is such good advice. I think One of the things that probably exacerbates the feeling inferior or like imposter syndrome in design is because you don't necessarily have the credentials that you can point to, where it's like, I have my doctorate or I have this or whatever. And it's like, you kind of have this sense of like, people have to feel you out first, or you have to like prove something anew and again to your peers when you're like coming on the scene or whatever. And it's not, you just can't point to like a certificate or something to stand for itself. And I think what you said is super helpful, especially like realizing what voices are not yours and which ones like should you listen to versus like, because you know, the opposite way is like, you just, you're unaware and you think you're awesome and you don't feel like you need to approve. That's this problem in and of itself. So it's like, you have to be like super self-aware, but also not too hard on yourself. It's tough.
It's tough. It's tough. And I think that's why I gravitated so much more towards my own study of mindfulness, because I think that really helps you kind of be present, right? It helps you kind of develop that awareness, cultivate that ability to be discerning rather than judging of things, and to kind of have space between you and the reactivity that you feel. And that's really important in everything that we do. I think so much of our work as designers is much more about communication. It's much more about those subtleties of the relationships that we have and things like that, that I think actually in this industry become your credentials a lot more than any paper that you get. Yep. More than even the stuff in your portfolio. You know, if you can be a good designer that really can understand what everybody's going through and like clearly communicate your needs and help people along the way, like that's going to take you much, much further than, yeah, any credential will.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So looking back at kind of your different phases of career, are there any like favorite moments that stick out or any low points that you look back and you learned from?
Yeah, I have a lot of favorite low points. There are so many. I think, you know, when I started working in Silicon Valley, I was just experiencing so many interesting things and really next level stuff. You know, up until then, I had kind of been doing everything sort of on my terms and with a smaller budget and scale of things. But sure, when I, you know, moved out here, I mean, like the level of VC funding happening and the amount of monies that these companies had to spend on products and resources, it was incredible. And I was working on a lot of SaaS products in health tech and medicine. And I got to work on some stuff for Stanford School of Medicine with a couple of startups and just like really interesting solutions being developed. And like, I remember getting to do some really interesting, like I would be designing pitch decks one day for VCs, and then, you know, they'd be doing fundraising with the MVP that I made through a demo day or something like that. So I got to do a lot of interesting things. I remember one time I got hired to come in and like consult on just branding and product design and everything for this AR VR company. And this was like, you know, 2016, maybe around there. And so this stuff was really early, early days. And I went to some like really random warehouse address in the middle of Redwood City. And I was greeted by this, like a bunch of tech bros, for lack of a better word, just kind of all in hoodies standing outside. And they sort of ushered me into this warehouse, and it was all dark. There were no lights on. I'm like, yes, this is my last day on earth. But they gave me these colored glasses. They gave me an iPad, and they were like, okay, put these glasses on. And then like, I was holding this iPad sort of in front of me, under me. And then all of a sudden I saw a human heart just floating in the middle of the room, and I could just spin it around with my hand and like move it. And I'm like, I am in the future. I have just,
yes, you're in the metaverse.
Into the future. And so, I mean, yeah, this was many, many years ago. So that kind of stuff really blew my mind. And those were some highs for me. I think two more like recent highs, definitely like when my very first student landed a really great job in UX, like not even finishing the course. it was just like 2 months in, and just like the mindset shift did it for her. That was a huge high. And then I think when my first YouTube video went viral, that was like, yeah, that was a big fun one for me.
Now, is that one the one on picking your color palette?
Picking colors of all things. Yep.
I was going to say, YouTube has been serving that one up to me quite a bit, and it is a great video. I encourage everyone to go out there and watch it.
That's so funny. I still think about that. Like, just like my face right there on everyone's, you know, just serving up. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
That's awesome. So in your career approach, did you kind of take a more generalist approach or more a specified niche down into like UX and product design?
That almost seems to insinuate that I knew what I was doing and I had an approach at the time, Seth. I really didn't. I just said yes to whatever anyone asked me to do. I remember one time being paid like $9,000 to write a business plan because the business plan person that was supposed to be finishing it just backed out of the project. And they were like, you write really well. Can you do this? Sure. It was just that I will say yes, and then I will figure it out as I go. That was kind of my approach. So I would definitely say generalist. And then the more things I put out and the more I saw what people responded to in terms of my work, then I sort of started to niche, I guess, and just specialize a little bit more into these things because I was getting signals from outside of what was more valuable to people. And I sort of went in that direction, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I think from my perspective, I kind of echo what your thoughts are on like, say yes to everything and figure out how to do it. Just because like I started out in like front end development.
Right.
And if I had at that point just been like, this is what I am, I'm going to niche down. Like, I don't think I would have reached my full potential of what like I was meant to do. And I had to like go through these periods of like trying new things, be like, ugh, don't like that. Or like, I really do like that. And the beautiful thing about the web and doing these things is like, it's not an exam where you have to have the answer today. You can try something and you can probably figure it out. You can stumble your way through it. You can post on different forums. You can watch different videos. You can read tutorials and you can probably figure it out if you have the time and the determination. And that understanding really freed me up to say yes to so many things.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of that mindset thing where sometimes you just have to put it out there and try it to know.
Exactly. And I feel like another one of my like core philosophies is that anything that you put out there into the world, whether it's content, whether it's just like posting shots on Dribbble, whether it's writing things, you know, design tips on Twitter or just connecting with people, those things always come back like tenfold to you in the future versus just like not putting out anything and just like hoping you get that one opportunity. Yeah. And like, you know, it's like just continually trying to put feelers out there, network, put your work out there, put yourself out there, and eventually it's going to stick.
Yeah, that's just it. Like the more, I mean, maybe this isn't the best analogy, but kind of the more lotto tickets you play, maybe the better your chances are, but just the more.
Yeah, you increase your odds. Opportunity. Yeah,
exactly. Definitely does, for sure.
Absolutely. So any specific low points that you can think of that you learned anything from during your time?
Yeah, you know, I think startup world was a double-edged sword for me because lows really came from working at some of those startups, right? And also from failing at my own. But over the years, I witnessed some really crazy things just happening in the industry, right? This just sort of massive amount of VC funding, you know, that was kind of near blindly being pumped into the startup ecosystem at that early 2000s, mid-2000s. It was that coupled with these engineering-led agile practices, and then that like build fast, break thing, lean mentality. It just sort of added up to this kind of, shall we say, ethically precarious like situation for a lot of founders that they would find themselves in.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was very little understanding of or practice of UX either, or why it was needed. It was much more like, we're going to come up with an idea. This is the C-suite team or whatever it is, and they're engineers, and we're going to build it. And then we're going to figure out how to sell it to people, rather than the other way around of kind of like finding that product market fit first, asking users first, looking at the problem first kind of approach, right? That user-centered way of thinking. And so, you know, when you have a lot of money and you're aiming to really grow and scale rapidly like that, I think that was kind of the way it was done. And it worked, you know, well for a while. A lot of the big companies that we all know started out that way, but it doesn't work in the long term. You really do see the difference when competition increases in the marketplace, when user savvy shifted and everyone had an iPhone in their hands, you know, and everyone can be a voice about, you know, your product and stuff like that. So it wasn't just these power users that they were appealing to anymore. It was just everyone. It was everyday people. And so, yeah, you know, I think that's when there was a real change and people started to listen up and say, hey, you know, maybe this isn't the best way to do it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm sure you have tons of stories from the, you know, being in the Valley for so long and all of your experiences there that would be awesome to get into it. Probably another podcast, but I wanted to think about like where you are today. If you were to look back and give your younger self advice as you're starting out in your career, what would you advise your younger self on?
My younger self. So you're talking about like, you're talking about like unidimensional time space travel, or are we talking multiverse theory here? What do we need? What becomes? Okay, like for the sake of, you know, like avoiding any unwanted paradoxes of existence.
We'll just, yeah, that, you know, that could really mess
that
things
can mess
up.
Things up, right? Like, we may not be sitting here talking about this at all, so we got to be careful with this stuff.
That is a deep thought. I've never gone there. You're going to change your trajectory if you give your former self too much insight right here.
That kind of thing. But no, I would probably say things are probably not going to turn out in the future the way you expect them to from where you sit now. There's a lot of experience left that could change things for you. So just be really open, I think, to what could be. And you never know what worse luck your bad luck is saving you from. I think that that has happened to me in so many occasions where I thought this is the worst thing ever that could happen. And then I realized that, wow, this actually led me to someplace even better, or it actually avoided something really bad happening. So sometimes I think that's just a reminder to, even when bad things happen, to just kind of be open and be grateful no matter what's kind of coming your way. And then probably drink more water. Yeah. Don't drink enough water.
All great advice. Yeah. I think, you know, it's just so crazy to think back to, like, you know, the like 2020 and like all of the jobs that weren't around then that are just like exploding now, like anything from like SEO expert to UX design to even now like product design. And my personal theory is that the more technology advances, obviously certain jobs get automated and replaced, but I think there's always going to be like new jobs coming and evolving and like coming out like that we can't even wrap our minds around.
Exactly.
Like, you think back a couple hundred years ago, something crazy like 96% of people were farmers.
Yeah.
Right?
And
everyone had to be freaking out when all of those tools and things were getting automated. But like, I love your advice about just, you know, hey, maybe you are in a dead end career. Maybe it feels like the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
But maybe it's the opportunity of a new start, really, and a better career.
Yeah. Because I've seen it so many times over with so many people. And sometimes that it just takes that for you to realize it, you know, and to actually be pushed to try something new and to not be complacent and sort of to step out your comfort zone.
Yeah. Awesome. So I'm really interested to get a little bit more insight into how you got into teaching design and kind of your design mentoring philosophy in your company, Designer Up.
Yeah. So funny enough, I think it was all of my experiences in startup that really was the catalyst for me wanting to teach again and revive that love of teaching, because I kind of found that you know, when companies are building these products or when they reach a certain size, they come up against all of these little lesser of two evils decisions, right? You know, you come into these positions where a founder might be faced with the choice to fire half of his design team to save the company, or maybe sell a little bit of user data to save everyone. And it's never as clean and easy as people think it is. And I think designers who obviously may never have founded a company before or are not very close to the business side of it, sometimes we get so precious about our design work and we don't realize the bigger picture. We don't know the bigger picture. We feel we take it as a direct affront or assault when someone doesn't like our designs, and there's just so much more at play. And so that's something that I've really started to want to think about. Like, I was just questioning it for myself. It's like, is there a different way to move forward and create the types of businesses and the types of products that I can be proud of and that are more ethical, businesses that are more sustainable? And I think these are the questions that kind of led me to asking that, like, how many designers really know about some of these things, and how did I go about addressing them when I was faced with them? And can I give them some of that insight without maybe them having to kind of found a company themselves? You know, maybe if it's just going into a team, getting a full-time job, and being able to communicate with people and developing that. And I really drawed from my mindfulness practice for that, because I think it's such a gentle and effective way to be able to, you know, cultivate those things. And, you know, empathy is, I think, a term that gets thrown around a lot, but I don't think it's something that you just kind of whip out of your design tool belt when you want to. I don't think it's something that you can just build into a persona. I think it's something that you've really got to cultivate and practice regularly. Like when you show up and, you know, your husband's pissing you off and you just, you know, it's like, how do you practice then? How do you practice when someone cuts you off on the highway? How do you practice, you know, in those little moments? And I think that's what really develops that for you. So yeah, that's really the core foundation of what I teach. A lot of it is soft skills. A lot of it is based, yeah, you know, like psychological principles of nonviolent communication, of psychological flexibility, of how do you develop a growth mindset rather than a fixed mindset. These are the kinds of skills that will give you the power to address anything that comes your way. Because like, you know, Seth, it's problem solving stuff we're doing. I guess the channel through which we do it is visual deliverables, right? And like things like that, but that's not really what it is. You know, that's just, it's just the surface level stuff.
That's super interesting. So yeah, you're taking the approach of teach a man to fish rather than, you know, Draw these rectangles and do these things.
Totally.
That's really cool. So how long have you been running Designer Up, and how has that gone?
Yeah, so we're in going on 4 years of our boot camp and our course, and it's been pretty incredible. The things the students are building and the jobs and the good work that they're doing, I think they're, you know, we've attracted such a kind, thoughtful, compassionate bunch of people that are just really thinking hard. And I think really bringing all of the struggles and kind of, I guess, traumas that they've had in their lives and just looking at ways to apply technology to that in a way that is, you know, least harmful as possible. I think we're kind of always capable of doing harm at all times. Like we may not see the effects of it, the cause and effect of everything that we do. And so, you know, I don't take an anthropocentric view of the world where like humans are the most important thing on the planet. I think there's so much more at play. There's so much more that's important about nature and, you know, other sentient things. And I think that's just kind of part of like the broader spectrum of like the social and emotional and psychological and economic impacts of technology. So seeing them consider that and having these conversations about that, I think is really just what's been wonderful about it. So yeah, Designer Up has been grown pretty rapidly. I mean, the channel, the YouTube channel kind of really kicked that off a lot too. There I do a lot more of the little tools and hard tips and skills like that. But the course is kind of the thing I'm so proud of and love to spend time, you know, working with students like every day.
Yeah, that's really cool. So now, like, kind of like we were talking about earlier, there's a lot of different ways someone could go to get into design. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of different boot camps. There's the self-taught route. There's, you know, college for interaction design or, you know, some sort of a psychology, you know, background for research. What does DesignerUp do that's different, or what's its unique take that kind of separates it or gives it its own unique flavor from the other options that might be available?
Yeah, I think a lot of it now has become about the teacher. I think if you vibe with the teacher a lot and you know, I guess, kind of the way that you learn best, or you someone that really needs to have your hand held and be like challenged every week on a very strict schedule, you need to be able to show up this time and you want to be able to do things in a very social manner, like maybe a big boot camp with that kind of cohort based style is for you. And I think that first step is just to know yourself. And then if there's a teacher in particular that you connect with, that can go a long way with helping you kind of discover yourself and what you're good at in your path. And really, I think kind of like, for me, looking at platforms and curriculums and teaching, I think it's kind of always been like, there are those teachers that will kind of pass on everything that they know to you and show you kind of hard skills and that sort of thing. But then there are also the ones that are like that really great baseball coach you might have had that will come up, look at your arm, look at your form, adjust you, and put you into position that's kind of the best for you. And then you throw the ball. And so I feel like there's a little bit of that touch in what we do in DesignerUp. And definitely, you know, designers entering the workforce now as professionals today, they need to kind of be able to meet organizations where they're at. And that's kind of the reality of design and working in agile environments and having to deal with pushback and defending your design decisions and that sort of thing. But most of the boot camps are just teaching the ideal, right? They're teaching the ideal of what user-centered practices are and what, you know, we should be doing in our design thinking process. And if everything works out in this straight line, that's how, you know, it's going to be. But I think we have to realize that we kind of have to meet them where they are in order to get them to reach that ideal. And we're just part of that bigger mechanism, right, that's happening, that's bringing these products to life. So that's what we're teaching. It isn't a UX bootcamp. It is a product design bootcamp. Very squarely, you're learning business principles, you're learning strategy. We're employing things like jobs to be done and lean canvas and things like that, that you're just not going to really come across in UX, just UX bootcamp. So yeah, there's that. And then mindfulness is a big part of it. So we do a lot of these mindful exercises and things like that, so that hopefully what comes out in the end is, you know, as ethically sound as it can be. At least we've considered those things. It's more accessible, it's more inclusive, and, you know, we're kind of going a little bit deeper than just the mock-ups and the wireframes, but you will end up with those too. So,
sure. Now, when you say mindful practices, are you speaking to just like considering everything from ethics to accessibility, or is it more of like a problem-solving type of mindfulness?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's mostly kind of the ability to cultivate the kind of awareness that makes you less reactive, and that you can kind of take other people's perspective into consideration. Because I think that when we're super reactive and when we don't know how to communicate nonviolently, and these are kind of principles that are pulled from like mindfulness psychology and things of, you know, like Jon Kabat-Zinn talks about a lot, and a lot of great mindfulness and psychological practitioners. It's a lot of these mindset things that, you know, I think like some of the questions that I'm always asking are really not much about what I'm doing and how it looks, but a lot more of like, how can this design make the engineers' jobs easier? And do I even know what they're really doing and what they're up against, right? Can I like be mindful of that in a sense? And how can I de-risk the design investment for the company? What struggles are they facing? And again, this is like all around how you develop empathy, right? But just kind of paying attention, giving yourself space, being able to step back, not taking things too personally, right? like, how can my design enhance the parts of the product that's going to help bring the most value to the users? So those are the types of questions that we're asking, because it's very much like, it's not all about me and my designs. Like, there's so much more stuff to consider. So that's kind of how I would define it.
Yeah, interesting. I think it's a really cool angle because, yeah, you're not just teaching UX design, visual hierarchy, but like business skills and thinking and strategy. And one thing, going back to what you were saying about like the ideal process, I think once people get into client work, they'll quickly realize that things are usually over budget and under time, and you have to make cuts somewhere. So it's like, you have this process. Ideally, you would do, you know, it from start to finish like this, but you have to be smart enough to know where you can cut corners, where the priorities lie, and where you need to flex on your process in order to accomplish the business goals.
Yes, it's those little trade-offs, and that's really what you need to learn how to make. But I mean, you've definitely got to practice your craft for a long time. It's probably going to take a lot more hours than you think. You know, you've got to put in the time to design a ton of ugly mocks just over and over again and get really depressing feedback from people and battle your inner imposter over time. That's all part of it. It's really a big part of it. And that's why I think it's important to not get burned out in the process and to not be a source of more of your own stress in that way, to kind of like, you know, just take it on the shoulder a little bit. So yeah, but that's all true. What you're saying is really, yeah, you learn a lot in that process.
From your point of view, what do you think the qualities and characteristics that companies are looking for in designers today?
I think that's such a general question, and I really think it depends a lot on the type of company and the industry. If you Sure. are going to work at a very large enterprise, you're probably going to be starting as an individual contributor, kind of on the production line, doing that sort of thing. I think that's when you're more tactical. As you go up in the ladder in that type of profession, you get more strategic. You need to be more strategic, and you need to have a lot more leadership qualities. I think that that's really important. It becomes a game of not designing things and mocks, but designing organizations and people and how you put those together as you get higher up. In the startup world, it's about being super fast and just shipping. Like, you need to have it done yesterday all the time, and you're going to iterate on the fly, and you're just going to have to be able to make really quick decisions. And, you know, I remember being in a live meeting with a bunch of, you know, of the founders, and as they're describing to me what they want the product to look like, I'm live prototyping for them. And the pressure is very real and very intense. So if you're that type of person, and I was for a little bit until it burnt me out. So, you know, it's hard to sustain that. But, and, you know, they're really looking at how can we get fundraising, right? They're looking at engagement, and they're looking at, you know, just how to convert. And you're talking about sales funnels a lot, and, you know, you're just trying to grow really rapidly. So that's a very different mindset than this one with the article every day, show up, design some stuff, or, you know, contribute to an existing design system. And then, of course, if you're a freelancer, then you've got the whole business part to consider, and how you sell, right? How you sell yourself, how you brand yourself, how you present things, how you negotiate contracts, that sort of thing is a big part of that. So, yeah, I would say definitely depends on sort of the career ladder that you might take. But, you know, you can always swing to other branches as well. I know I'm mixing metaphors there, but yeah.
Sure. Yeah, no, I get you. I get what you're saying. I think from my perspective, like, and again, this is me being a little bit more on like the UI side of needs.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of people come out of boot camps with extremely thorough research and like a very, very thorough research process. And it's really hard, in my opinion, to separate yourself from other people when the bulk of everything that you're doing as a generalist UX designer is research. Because research, it's one of those things that's kind of like maybe we have the budget for a lot of it. Maybe we have the budget for a little bit of it. And it's more so permission to do it rather than like, I have a better process than this person or that person, right? And I feel like there's less, maybe less skill or maybe less emphasis on the UI side of things, where it's just like, if you got it, you got it. If you're good at that, you're good at that. And that's like speaks for itself, right? So again, very dependent on like what you're looking, what the skill set is, what you're going for. But in the bootcamp type resumes that I've seen, they're pretty heavy on the research side and not as developed on the UI side.
That is so true. I think, you know, what you're saying kind of like amounts to UI is the easy sell. UX is the hard sell to companies, but at the same time, UX is kind of the easy part to learn and show, but UI is the hard part to do and show, because it's one of those things where you really have to just over time practice and practice and practice to get better. You don't just develop a design eye for proportion and scale and ratio just like that. But the thing is that because I had seen it so much, and I was a mentor at some of the big boot camps before I started my own thing for many, many years. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And I see it in the curriculum. I see how little practice you really get in that. But one of the problems is there is so much theoretical stuff that gets taught about color. And that is exactly what inspired me to do that video. I had seen hundreds and hundreds of videos on color theory and the color wheel, and not one person I ever met knew how to apply it. No one I ever spoke to in design, professional or otherwise, or student, ever said, yeah, this is like a triadic color scheme that I applied because I mastered the color wheel. No one.
Right.
No one ever. And so I said, why is that? Why don't we talk about color the same way that we like talk about paint or something, like where, you know, and we have math like inside of our design applications, we have numbers and HSB values that we can use. Why are we not talking about it that way? And I just spent almost 2 months just testing every color family and finding out what is at the core of what makes a color look pleasing next to another color. And essentially, it's things that we all already know, but we just never put together. And it's just this idea of like, we see jewel tones, and you're not going to see like a really, really like fluorescent jewel. You're going to see like that rich, deep, dark ruby color and that sort of thing. So inherently, we're kind of programmed to see these things, but we're just not aware of it yet. So that's what that color video was about. And then if you're completely colorblind, which so many designers I know, some of the greatest designers you might not even realize in the product design world don't see color that well, but you can just put math into your design app and it will spit out a good color palette. Of course, there are tons of tools for that and you can use that, but like when you need to just tweak a green to make it match your, you know, your yellow just a little bit more, this is the lever that you can push and pull. And I think that's kind of what I try to, I guess, collect and like distill down from everything that I've seen and learned into a way that kind of takes out the guesswork for beginners. Cause that's what's hard.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much guesswork. Like, we don't know the typography in relation to the size of the button if it's taking up too much space. But if you start to understand proportion a little better and you have actual numbers to start from on a grid, you start there. And then eventually you can break the grid and eventually you can experiment with crazier color combinations, but take the guesswork out to start with. And I think that's like, you know, what you're saying is if you do that and you practice enough, those UI skills become second nature. And that is something that's pretty sought after right now. If you have that research, but you have an outstanding portfolio. I mean, at the end of the day, recruiters are still kind of basic when it comes to that. If they see this crazy, crazy, gorgeous looking design, like it's still going to catch their eye and you still might have that better chance of them then looking at your research. I mean, unless you're going
to
like a specific UX research position, right? And that's your specialty, then yes, go all in on that, right? But yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, Seth. So true.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old saying, like you have to fall in love with the face before you fall in love with the heart. It's kind of like you know, in design, you gotta show that you can make these beautiful designs in addition to being able to do good research. If you can get that combo, you're going to be unstoppable. And again, like you said, just comes with time. There's nothing magic. I think one thing I always tell people is like, do as much copying as you can. Get ingrained into your head what the patterns are, what the biggest, best companies use. Be able to just copy for copying's sake, so you can like burn that into your memory and you can pull that out when a situation comes where you need, you know, a workflow with like two buttons. It's like, oh, I've designed this or I've seen this.
Yeah.
And like the ability to copy well and adapt patterns is something that I preach over and over.
Absolutely. That foundational stuff, it has to be first and foremost. You've got to learn it. But it's easy to learn and it's easy to practice. You just have to be consistent. But I really think that it's about how you reason your design choices that matter. Because you can take the exact same design and in any different situation at a different time at a different company, you might have it pushed forward. You know, for instance, if I was at a startup and their main objective is to get more signups, well, you bet I'm going to have a big, brightly colored signup button right at the top of the hero. But if that's not the goal, then that same design choice can be reasoned differently. And I've seen many designers that are simply very good at selling the ROI behind their design and can sell a very non-aesthetically pleasing design, but they're just really good at reasoning it and the logic behind why they made that choice, and that will go forward. And to be honest, a lot of the sites that we all use, I mean, I don't think Amazon's very beautiful, but I use that approximately 700 times a day.
That's right.
But it is not like the gorgeous stuff I see on Dribbble. It's not like Slack's homepage, for example, or something like that. But it depends, right? And I hate saying that, and people probably don't like hearing it, but it really is true. It's so situational based. So I always say, become a contextual designer. Be flexible, right? Just what's the context, and get good at negotiating and your reasoning behind the design choice.
Yeah. And knowing when is something you want to stand firm on, when is something you can give up. Because it's like anytime there's human interactions or whatever, if you're going to be a hard nose about everything, people are just not going to want to work with you. But if it's like, if you're like, oh, I can give up this, but then you save what you really want to keep in your design or your, you know, your product, there's that give and take that everyone kind of subconsciously like tallies, and it's like, okay, we can work with that. I'll give up a little bit of what I want. You give up a little bit of what you want. And it's that like ability to be flexible and easy to work with that's going to ultimately help you navigate like the social skills you need to be able to be successful in a company. Cause like the design is one piece, but like working well with others is, you know, probably an even more important life skill to 100%. Take away from that.
Yeah, because your design could be changed tomorrow. The company could go under tomorrow. You're definitely not going to see that design very long. I mean, it will be changed like very, you know, as soon as it leaves your hands. I learned that early on not to get too precious about my design work. It's just, it's not really about me. At the beginning, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this vision of mine is just gone, you know, like, they want to change everything. But after a while, you don't care anymore. And you say in service of the overall product and the overall vision.
Yep.
And then because I still secretly can't take it, I start a YouTube channel where it's only my vision and no one can tell me what to do and how to make my videos. And if I need to express it that way, then I will. And that's something that's just mine. And I just can say like, this is just me kind of sharing my problem solving and workarounds and my own process with people. Yep. So take it where you can, but you know, most of the time it's a big compromise. So yeah, get comfortable with
it. I think that's great. Cause like when I was working in agencies, there's all these like requirements. There's all these things of, you know, the client needs and wants to keep it like the old way. They want to keep something, you know, it could be completely arbitrary. It could be good, but you have a lot of requirements you're working with. Mm-hmm. And like one thing I found that I was enjoying is just like posting things on Dribbble, and they had zero like use case behind them, zero UX. And it was literally just like, just for fun. This is just me designing without any, restrictions. And people are like, Dribbble would get dunked on for, pun intended, would get dunked on for like, oh, there's no UX behind this. Or like, it's like, yeah, well, that's kind of the point. Like, this is my playground. This is where I don't have to be worried exactly about those requirements. And that helped me a lot in my visual design, just to be able to play and not worry about, the strict requirements, or I don't know what happens when you click this button. It just looks cool there. I like that really, that gradient. It's fun. I don't know.
Sometimes, there's just so many considerations, and it's just like, sometimes you just can't take it seriously because you're never going to remember everything. You're never going to be perfect at it. You're never going to please everyone. So sometimes you just can't take it too seriously. I mean, you're just designing laps on screens at the end of the day sometimes. So yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Elizabeth, this has been great. I am super excited to share this with our audience and share your course and your platform. And I hope that together this episode and your company and my company are able to help designers reach their goal of finding really good, fulfilling jobs. And again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. And this podcast has been something that my students love listening to. So I encourage anyone out there to subscribe. There's some awesome stories on here, and just learning from everything you've been through has been really nice. So yeah, you can check me out at designerup.co and UX Cabin. Awesome podcast, Seth. Awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll be sure to link up everything in the show notes. And yeah, again, thank you so much. And we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Seth.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us today on the Product Design Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, be sure and go follow our guest. Let them know they did a great job and you learned a lot. More to come in the following weeks as we bring on new guests. Please hit that subscribe button so that you will get these podcasts and learn a ton about the product design community. Excited to see you next time. Thanks.